beauty and skincare is always a hot topic around here, and today I want to tell you about a new product line I've discovered that I think you will like, Exponent Beauty. Listeners of the show will receive 20% off their purchase. More details on that in a minute. Exponent Beauty is a skincare brand with a line of activated anti-aging serums that are clinically proven to reduce fine lines and wrinkles. The beauty of Exponent Beauty is their innovative form factor. The powders are activated with a quadruple hyaluronic acid serum in their patented precision-dosed dispenser. The packaging is gorgeous, and the dispenser itself is refillable, so it has also reduced plastic waste. Exponent Beauty's line of serums can be found in med spas, and dermatologists' office around the country. The line is dermatologist recommended and clinically proven to reduce those fine lines and wrinkles, and to increase brightness and radiance, and to firm skin without irritation. No more expired or underutilized products with Exponent Beauty, just high-quality skincare with ingredients that work. Go to exponentbeauty.com and use code TELL20 for 20% off a purchase of $100 or more. That's Exponent, E-X-P-O-N-E-N-T, Beauty, B-E-A-U-T-Y.com and use code TELL20, T-E-L-L, the numbers 20, for 20% off your purchase of $100 or more. Content warning for this episode includes child loss and suicide. Please take care while listening. I'm Laura Tremaine, and I have 10 things to tell you. And you have 10 things to tell. This show is about connection with each other and with ourselves. And the hope is that the things we talk about here will be fuel for better conversations and a personal awareness. This is an interactive podcast. Each episode has a prompt and a topic that I want you to take to your journal, text to your best friend, or answer on social media using the hashtag 10 things to tell you. This is a show about digging deeper and sharing our stuff. I'll go first. This episode is one of the most tender and important that I've ever shared on this show, and I am just so deeply grateful to my friend Amy Ortloff for having this conversation with me and letting me make it public. I grew up with Amy's husband, Steve, in our tiny town in Oklahoma of about 4,000 people. Steve is my sister's age, he has a younger brother my brother's age, and then another younger brother about my age, and our parents were very close friends when we were growing up. I have known this family my whole life. In 2017, Steve and Amy lost their middle child, Ryan, to suicide. Ryan was 17, he had just finished his junior year of high school. It was a devastating heartbreak, of course, to their family and to the whole community, really. About a week after Ryan died, Amy started posting on her Facebook page every single day. Little stories about Ryan, memories, what the grief felt like. Amy was diagnosed with PTSD, and eventually, alongside the stories of Ryan, she also started sharing things from therapy and the boundaries that she was setting up in her life, how to treat her, basically, what to say, what not to say. I didn't know Amy very well, even though I'd grown up with her husband, but we had been Facebook friends for a long time, and I watched her share herself every single day in the most vulnerable, raw way, and I actually think that it changed me. This was years ago. This was before I had honed in on my very specific message about sharing ourselves as a way to be known and as a way to be less lonely. And even though I had experienced the power of sharing in my own life, I think that watching Amy share through her grief is one of the things that really drove that point home to me, why sharing is so important. My conversation with Amy in this episode is primarily about that sharing and about that first year after Ryan died, and how Amy's sharing impacted a whole community, and how her words on Facebook saved lives. She also shares about her own grief process, what PTSD looks like for her, the boundaries that she set up in her workplace and on social media that helped her get through such a difficult time. This episode is not about mental health or suicide, but if you know someone who is struggling, please follow the guidelines set up by the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention. Talk to them in private, take them seriously, listen to their story, tell them you care, ask directly if they have plans to hurt themselves, and call the National Suicide Prevention Hotline at 1-800-273-8255. The primary goal of the 10 Things to Tell You podcast is to foster connection, to get us all sharing, to make us feel less alone. I am so honored to give you this important conversation with Amy Ortloff. She's a mom, wife, teacher, writer, speaker, and advocate. Let's just start a little bit. Well, where do you want to start?
Well, I think the easiest place to start is probably less than a week after he died is the very first time I wrote on Facebook. And I wrote about a little thing of Play-Doh sitting on his desk. He had started therapy a month earlier. He had been diagnosed with PTSD himself. And he came home from therapy one day and had this little thing of Play-Doh. And then he had a rock, and he talked about Play-Doh is moldable and we can change, and but the rock is permanent. And so that he can change some things and some things he can't. And he had set that out on his desk, and he would get it out sometimes and use it. And after he'd died, I found it on his desk, and the Play-Doh was sitting out, and it was hard. It was no longer pliable. You couldn't change it into anything. And that's what I shared on Facebook, was that now he has died, and nothing can change from that. So he was forever 17 at that point, and that was my very first post. It was only just a few sentences long, and then I just gradually shared every day either a picture of him or a memory of him, and I would somehow relate it to a present feeling that I was having, and it was a teeny tiny glimpse into my day, but it meant so much more for all of his friends that were following me on Facebook or any community member. And so I just learned to share a little bit more. What most people didn't know was when I would write on there, it would take me over an hour to write a few sentences. I would write that out, and then I would kind of process it and then reformat it. It was like doing my own therapy session, kind of, and putting it out there.
What was compelling you to share this intense grief on Facebook? Because we are family friends. We've been longtime family friends. I've known your in-laws since I was born, you know, and we were Facebook friends before Ryan died. And I don't remember if you posted a lot or not.
No, I didn't. I was not like that. It felt like I just didn't want him to be forgotten. I wanted to share bits and pieces of him. And the more I shared, the more instant feedback I got from people on, I didn't know that story. Tell me another story. Share more stories. And I was encouraged to share. And so it just became very every day. It was the start of my day every morning, and I would write something about him. And then I didn't look at Facebook till the end of the day, and I would see all the comments. Because it was a lot. Having to grieve on social media is not the same as like when I was younger and lost a grandparent. Ryan was my first grief. He really was. I've lost all my grandparents, but I was younger. They were all older. You know, it made sense. It was logical. And his death to me was not logical. It did not make sense. And so I learned a lot by sharing online that grief is not what I thought it was. And so teaching people to grieve with me, and maybe some of the comments they said I would delete.
Wait, say more about that. What kind of comments would you delete?
I had people that would write, "Don't forget you have two other children." Yeah, that was a really hard one.
And these were people you knew.
Friends, you know, or, I mean, of course, my friend list went from 300 to 900 within days of his death. You know, every one of his friends wanted to follow me and the entire community. But there were things like that, well-intentioned comments like, he's in a better place. It's true, he is in a better place, but, like, I miss him right here on Earth. Like, that's really hard.
That's right. That's not a helpful comment in with a child. I feel like people maybe say that kind of sentiment if, you know, with an older person who'd been very ill or something
or
like that.
Or even those kind of comments were made, like, I just lost my grandparent last week. It's not the same, and it's different. I mean, I don't want to compare any type of grief, even one child to the next. It's not a comparison, but in that moment of someone's greatest loss is not the time to talk about your own loss.
That's right.
Your pet or your distant cousin, I guess.
Let me ask about, because this is a teeny tiny town, and when your friend list went from your 300 right. people that you know to 900, did that feel comforting because people wanted to be with you in your grief, or did it feel like voyeurism or something, like people wanting to look
at
you?
I really saw it as comforting. I know some people around me thought that it was not appropriate, and I felt like that he really was loved. He was a dynamic kind of kid with a huge personality and a big smile, and I think he had a lot of friends and a lot of people who just really thought that he thought they were great too. I mean, he just made people feel good and laugh, and so I took it as people wanting to learn more about him, like they wanted to grieve with me. I was not offended by it at all. I really thought they just wanted to hear more about Ryan. And as the weeks went on, someone even mentioned the fact that I wrote about him every day was a reminder that he was gone to other people who were continuing on with their life, you know.
Mm-hmm. I remember watching you share after Ryan died, and at the beginning it was about Ryan, like you're mm-hmm. saying, like it was a lot of focus about what kind of kid he was, and I didn't know Ryan, so that was helpful for me. But then as the months went on, and I don't remember exactly, but I remember you sharing more about your own grief and sort of how you were feeling. And, you know, I'm on social media every day. I like social media. I think it's really important. And I have never seen someone share their real-time grief. It sort of feels more culturally appropriate for people to go hide in a hole with their sadness and then come out and be like, okay, I'm all better now. And I remember saying to my own parents at the time, who know your family, same thing of being like, I've never seen this. I think this is so brave. I'm going to cry. I'm sorry. I'm the one that's going to cry, not you.
I think
that's
we'll go
so
back and forth. Yeah.
Inappropriate that I'm the one that's going to cry about this. But I just thought, I've never seen anybody do this ever. And it is really important. But I am guessing, because I'm from this same small town, that maybe not everybody had that take on it, that right. you were sharing so bravely every day. So I don't want to focus too much on the negative here, because I know there are people that will help by it. But I do want to just get a feeling, like kind of what you're saying before we press record, when you went to Walmart or whatever, and there were people there who were probably seeing what you were posting, like, what was that like?
We didn't actually leave the house for a couple months. Because we couldn't leave the house. The amount of people that came to our home every day after he died was, I just couldn't, grief really taught me how much I'm loved. And so that was really hard, to have so many people constantly wanting to see us and wanting to check on us. And about a month out, our doctor told us that we needed to put a sign on the door and limit the time that they could come by, because we were still barely able to breathe. We were just so deep in it and so present in our community that it was hard for them. When we would see somebody for the first time that maybe hadn't come to the funeral or hadn't come to our house, if we saw them later on, they would take us back to day one. And that is hard. That is really hard, because we worked so hard to get to day 30. And I don't know, it's just, we couldn't go shopping for a long time. And when we finally did go to Walmart for the first time, I think it was about 2 months after, we left town. We went 30 minutes away. We didn't go to our Walmart so that we would hopefully not see anybody that we knew. I was diagnosed with PTSD right about a month after he died. And one of the homework assignments I got, which maybe we can talk about this in a minute, was that I had to leave the house because it was easier for me to stay home. But I had a fear of leaving the house because if I left the house, I would come back and find someone dead. So I wanted to stay home. I didn't want to leave. Well, one of my homework for therapy, I called it homework, was that I had to leave. And so we went to Dallas for 4th of July and stayed at a hotel. And we went to the giant furniture store there. And it was like being on vacation from our real life because no one knew us. Like we could walk down the aisles of this store. I had a complete meltdown in the middle. I just sat down on a couch and started to cry. But that didn't matter to me. I didn't know any of those people. It was so freeing to know I could go anywhere I wanted. Nobody knew what I was carrying. And as I walked through the store, I was like, I wonder if they've lost a child. Like, I really learned a lot of compassion and grace for people. And like some of the comments on Facebook that people wrote, it really taught me people don't know what's appropriate to say. And as the months went on with therapy, I learned more and more grace for others because their intentions were with love. They just didn't know. And so I just kept being told by my therapist and the doctor, you have to teach them how to grieve. You're teaching them every day by the way you're responding. And people would ask, how are you? Well, don't ask anybody grieving in the first month, how are you? I'm terrible. There's no answer for that. And so I taught people to say good morning instead, or hello, or it's nice to see you.
Tell me how you taught them that. Did you actually literally say, please don't ask me how are you? Please,
I wrote about it on Facebook at one point. I did.
And then did people in town follow suit?
They did. And I immediately also, when I could only go to work for about 15 minutes at a time. I started about 6 weeks after he died, and I went for about 15 minutes, and then I'd come home. And so every day I was seeing a new employee, and when they would say, you know, hello or whatever, how are you? I would always say, it's good to see you, and I would keep walking. I never answered the question. I'd just say, it's good to see you. Good morning. Good afternoon. I learned boundaries were very important for me, and I put a sign on my office door that said, I'm at work right now. Please do not ask me how I am, and limited talking about Ryan or talking about myself because I could only work for such a short amount of time that people would come in and try to ask me how Steve or our children are, and so I just had to set boundaries like that. I also got a little timer for my desk, like a sand thing. It was 5 minutes, and as people would come in, I would flip it, and they had no idea. And when the sand ran out, I said, I'm out of time. You have to leave. And they would have to get up and go. So I learned very quickly to make boundaries so that my work environment was a safe environment. That was something I learned in therapy very soon. I had special treatment. I still have special treatment. This is a small town. Ryan's best friend, his mom is our family physician. The therapist that I go to, her and the doctor were here almost every day after he died. I had special treatment at my job to have therapy come to me. I didn't have to leave my office. I had a fantastic principal that knew I couldn't talk in front of people yet. I couldn't be touched in front of people. So I was very guarded at my job where people were not allowed access to me. They had to now, instead of once they would come into my office and do whatever, they had to now email me. I was very protected, and they took away a lot of my job to help me heal. I know that the special treatment of if I had a moment at school, somebody would show up. You know, it was not, I had to do this on my own. I had a very big support team. Being diagnosed with PTSD right off the bat of this, I learned tools instantly. My very first symptom was about a month after he died. I think it was right after we came back from Dallas. We were going to some family friends for dinner, and my oldest son, Jeffrey, was home from college, and then our daughter, Emily, was 13 at the time. And my house is a ranch style house, and with the upper and lower living room that you can kind of circle through, okay? And so my husband Steve said, let's go, it's time to go. And he was going through the house turning off all the lights. And I was going through the house behind him turning on all the lights. And I didn't know what I was doing, and he didn't know what I was doing. And he kept thinking it was one of the kids going back to their room or turning on the lights. And he had circled through two or three times, and he finally kind of ran into me. And I just immediately started to hyperventilate and cry. I didn't know what was happening. He's like, why are you turning on all the lights? And I said, because if I leave, we're going to come back and we're going to find someone dead, is what it was. I mean, it wasn't exactly those words. And so I learned that if I left in the daytime, it didn't make a difference. But if I left in the night, I had to turn all the lights on, because the night that Ryan died, we left in the afternoon and he was fine. He was okay. He was sitting in this chair eating popcorn and doing great. And when we came home, it was night. And so I needed to change the lighting in the house. And so for months after that, I always turned on all the lights when I left, because I needed it to be bright when I came home, because it wasn't bright when I came home the night he was dead. And so I had to do a homework assignment of going out our front door and walking the driveway, because every time I would come in the garage door, I would have a panic attack, because I thought that I was coming into the house to find someone that had died. And I had to walk the driveway, come in the garage door a dozen times a day, over and over and over, and speak truths as I did it, to say, you know, that Ryan was no longer in pain, that Ryan was safe, that Ryan loved me. And I just spoke the same kind of truths over and over, and I would walk the driveway and I'd come in the garage door and I'd come inside the kitchen, and each time I did it, it was just a little bit better, a little bit better. And it took months and months and months. But then one night I came home from work, it was about 5:30, I'd worked late, and I made it in through the garage door and into the kitchen, and I was looking at the mail, and I smiled, and I remembered, I didn't think about it. Mm. It was the very first time, and then immediately I started to cry. I was like, ah, but I did it. I did it one time. And so the next day I went to therapy, and I told her, and she said, yes, but you did it one time, so it's going to happen again. And, I mean, it took weeks before it happened again, but then it happened again.
But tell me, were you crying because, like, out of relief, like, I did it, or were you crying out of...
I forgot. It was so hard.
It's almost like you hold on to... Mm-hmm.
It was so upsetting. Mm-hmm. That it was around 4 or 5 months, the first day I didn't cry that he had died. It was the end of the day, and I realized that I hadn't cried yet. And it was like, oh, I did it. I made it through the day. And then I cried out of guilt. Because how could you... It wasn't that I forgot he died, but it was like, I made it a day without crying, and... That was an awful feeling. Mm-hmm. It was awful to laugh the days following his death, when people would come into my house and they were, you know, because that's what people do when you're grieving. You tell stories and you laugh, and there was just so much noise. It was really hard. We've struggled with being happy. I didn't ever want to be happy again. Mm-hmm. I still don't want to be happy. I don't. It's just a struggle. And so for that very first time dealing with the PTSD of saying, okay, I made a step. That was a huge step. I made it inside the house without thinking of that flashback, of that memory, then this is working. And so I kept doing that work of walking the driveway, and sometimes I would get in the car, back it up, and drive around and park the car and, like, do the actual reenactment of the night and try and get in. And just gradually, over and over time, there are more days that I don't have the flashback than the days that I do have. I can now walk in the house and not have that trigger. Now I have... Every day I have something. I've never gone a day without. Even if I'm on vacation, it's way better for me to not be here. But it happens somewhere, everywhere, every day. I'll have some kind of trigger. But the tips and tools I've learned in therapy have made it where people don't realize that I may be sitting across from you and having a flashback, and I'm doing the tools in my mind. You saw me before we started. I have a menthol item stick, and that is my biggest trick. I learned it about 2 weeks after he died. My therapist gave me baby bath that's menthol item for like when your baby's sick.
Oh, uh-huh.
And she said, try this when you take your nightly bath. It's very opening.
It's like Vapo Rub.
Yeah, it's like, it makes you breathe in, you know?
Oh.
And mm-hmm. So it makes me take a breath in. It makes me kind of, okay, take a breath. You're not breathing. Like, I had to remind myself how to breathe. So I use that as a trick a lot of times. And now that, you know, I have a mask on, a lot of the times I can sneak it up there and people don't even know what I'm doing. I'll put peppermint essential oils in my mask if I know I'm going somewhere stressful. It makes me breathe and stay present because mm-hmm. I need to stay present. I also learned to have something in my hands if I have to talk about something, a stuck point in therapy or something. I'll go with the squeezy ball or Play-Doh or silly putty, but I love to knit. Knitting is my best way, and I can really disconnect from whatever I'm having to talk about, and my voice becomes much clearer, and there's not as much pain there.
Yeah.
With sunshine, outdoor activities, and so many fun things to do outside, it is impossible not to enjoy all of these good weather days up ahead. Of course, we all know that more sun and fun means more sweating, and yes, more odor. That's why I'm excited to tell you about Lumi. Lumi is the first of its kind in the full body deodorant world and is seriously safe to use on any and every part of your body. It was created by an OBGYN who saw firsthand how regular body odor was being misdiagnosed and mistreated. I especially love that Lumi deodorant is baking soda and paraben free. It is also pH balanced for safe use on all areas of your body. You can choose from a variety of fresh scents like clean tangerine, lavender sage, and toasted coconut. Lumi's starter pack is perfect for new customers. It comes with a solid stick deodorant, cream tube deodorant, two free products of your choice like a mini body wash or deodorant wipes, and free shipping. As a special offer for listeners, new customers get $5 off a Lumi starter pack with code U at LumiDeodorant.com. That equates to 40% off your starter pack when you visit Lumi, L-U-M-E, deodorant, deodorant.com and use code U, Y-O-U. I have been lamenting the dinner time rush for years now, but with the help of Factor, it's one less thing to worry about every night. I am partnering with Factor this year, and I would love to tell you about it. Factor's ready-to-eat meals are healthy, delicious, and quick to serve. There are 35 weekly options to choose from, with options like vegetarian, protein plus, and keto. There are also over 60 snack, breakfast, and drink add-on choices to round out your menu. All of Factor's meals are pre-prepared, chef-crafted, and dietitian-approved. What I love the most about Factor's restaurant-quality food is how fast your meal is ready. All you have to do is pop your meal in the microwave for 2 minutes, heat, and then eat. Heat. And then eat. That's it. Okay, actually, maybe my favorite thing about Factor is that these meals come right to your door. You can also pause or reschedule your delivery at any time. There is no prep, no cooking, and no cleanup. It is a win-win all around. Head to factormeals.com/tell50 and use code TELL50 to get 50% off. That's code TELL50, T-E-L-L, then the numbers 50, at Factor, F-A-C-T-O-R, meals, meals.com/tell50 to get 50% off.
You have knitting needles in your hand right
yeah,
now.
Yeah, I'm tapping them. So I try not, but those are some of the tricks I've learned.
Well, I have so many questions about this. The first one is, because you started therapy, you know, right after Ryan died, were you already in therapy before that? Like,
no.
Were you open to therapy? Like, I think a lot of people, if they don't already have that practice in their life, that feels like a big task to take on. So how did you know, not how did you know, but like, you know, there was no taboo of people saying you need to start therapy or...
It was the night that he died, the therapist was here. She was one of the people that showed up and she said, I'm your after. And she came every day after.
And she was someone you knew?
No, I didn't know her. Now, my husband went to high school with her. You know, this is a small town, but I'm not from here. I didn't know her. She was my son's therapist, but he had only been, you know, less than a month in therapy. I didn't have anything wrong. I didn't have any taboo ideas about it or anything. I didn't know I was really going to therapy, I bet, the first few weeks, because she was coming here to my house. I didn't go to her office till a full year after. She would come to my office at school, or I would meet her at my house. But the first month, she was here every few days, or the doctor was here every day, and they were looking for my symptoms. I didn't know it at the time. I had no idea. Mm-hmm. They were watching me. They suspected it was going to happen. And so I didn't plan to go to therapy. It just happened. And then a few days, you know, maybe a week after he had died, we had her meet with my son and daughter. It just became part of our daily routine.
I keep hearing the pluses and minuses of a small town, in that you are cared for and watched in a healthy way and things. But then, you know, the other part of it is you can't go anywhere without someone knowing what has happened in your life. Mm-hmm. And so I think it's interesting that you balance that, or you took control of that narrative by posting every day, because you would have lived in this town no matter what. And so you could have let everyone else assume what was happening, or you could be like, I'm going to control, you know, this, and post about it every day. I think it's so hard to do that. I can't do that now without tragedy. I can't sometimes post what's going on with me, because it is so hard.
Mm-hmm. But they were only seeing a little bit of it, you know, like I eventually wrote a book that's still just sitting there in my computer, and the book has all those Facebook posts. But it tells you the flip side of what really happened. So if I said I had a hard day at school today and I'm grieving this or that, then it actually says I sat in the parking lot for 30 minutes. I couldn't get out. It was telling you the real story behind what the Facebook post was, and giving you more of the mental health on, I had totally talked myself into thinking that I was not loved and not needed. I struggled every day with being loved. I never...
You mean before Ryan died, or after?
After. I never doubted I was loved before he died. I never struggled with mental health. I never had suicidal thoughts. But after he died, I did not feel loved. I did not feel needed or wanted. I just felt so empty and so lost. And it was overwhelming for people to love me, because it felt like that was for them. Like, they're loving me for them. No, this isn't what I want. Because all of a sudden, I was a person that loved to hug, that loves to touch, that I'm a touchy person, and I couldn't stand to be touched. You cannot touch me. I actually people had to start guarding me, like at church. My son would go before me, or my husband, because people would want to come and hug me, and I couldn't handle it. I just could not be touched. The difference was at school. I worked in an elementary school that year, and I could be hugged all day long by children. They didn't have those expectations like an adult. They were just totally innocent. It was like, oh, they need a hug. I'm going to hug them when they got off the bus. And that was one of the best therapy my principal gave me, was morning bus duty. I had to greet every kid, because I couldn't talk the first 30 minutes of the day. I couldn't talk to adults. I just couldn't find words. And so the kids would get off the bus and I would say good morning. And they taught me how to talk. You know, that was a nice little 20-minute warm up with kids, and then I could go into the building most of the time. Sometimes I would go back home. But just once again, I had special treatment. Ryan was the first student that had died from suicide in our high school. So the school didn't know what to do with me.
In history?
As far as I know, or at least in recent history. Now, students that had graduated had died from suicide. He was the first student enrolled in school. It was right after his junior year. He died June 5th. And I was a school employee. It was a double, like, they didn't know what to do with me. They didn't know how to address the student body. And so I was really just given free rein to wander. And I would go to the high school every day and check on his friends. And that just turned into kind of a magical thing, because as I would go over there, I would see them. And then another student had died from suicide a town away, like in August, right after school started. And so I went over to check on kids. And then there was another death in a different town away. And so I talked to the student body. It was these amazing things I didn't know I would ever do. And I just kind of became a presence at the high school in a very casual way of being there. And then one day, it was about 9 months later, my therapist called me in my office at work and said, there's a student that wants to come see you. And she said who it was, and I didn't remember him. He was friends with Ryan in middle school, and he was now in high school. And I think he was a year younger than Ryan. And I'm like, sure. I had no idea why he wanted to come see me. And so he came and he sat with me in my office, and he just started talking about how hard school was and kind of pouring out how difficult it was in different sports and an ex-girlfriend and life, and he was having a hard time. And I was just listening to him talk about all this stuff, and I was still like, why is he here? Why is he coming to see me? And he said, well, I just wanted to check on you, and I wanted to see if you were okay. And I remember looking down at the floor and hearing myself say, tell the truth. And I looked back up at him and I said, I will never be okay. And he started to cry, and we talked a little bit more, and for some reason, I don't know why, I said, do you have plans to hurt yourself? And he answered yes. And I said, what is your plan? And he told me his plan. And we talked for a few more minutes, and I walked him out to his truck, and I told him exactly what he was going to do, and he handed something over to me, and he left. He went straight to the hospital. I trusted him to do that. I immediately called the therapist, and she sent the police to the hospital, and the steps of what you have to do for that situation began. And so he left. I was still very, like, kind of disconnected from it all. And I walked back in, and my principal came into my office and said, what happened? Because he was in there for about an hour. And I told him the whole story, and I said, the night that Ryan died, my husband and I prayed for good to come. And good has come. And I said, if just one life can be saved, it'll be worth it. And now there's this life. I mean, this just happened, you know, but it doesn't work like that. You can't trade one for another. It doesn't work like that. And I got so angry, and my principal said, have you ever heard the story of the starfish? And I was like, no, and I don't care. And I was just so mad. You know, if I had a stapler, I would have thrown it at him. And he's like, no, I want to tell you this story. And it, you know, the story of the starfish.
I know.
Okay, well, there's this man and this boy walking down the beach, and the tide has come up, and there's starfish all along the shore. And so the boy's picking up the starfish and putting them back in the ocean. And they're walking for a while, and he keeps putting them back in. And they finally stop, and the man says, what are you doing? And he's like, I'm saving the starfish. I'm putting them back in the ocean. He's like, there's too many. You'll never make a difference. And they continue walking, and the little boy sees another one, picks it up, and puts it in the ocean and says, made a difference to that one. Like, I mean, he put me in my place right then. Like, I asked for good to come. This boy just came into my office, and I somehow asked him, do you plan to kill yourself? And he said yes, and that has now stopped. He went immediately into suicide watch, and, you know, now 3 years later, he's doing great and is this great story. But I needed to hear that. Like, you just made a difference to this one, and you're so angry you can't even see what just happened. Mm-hmm. And so I didn't know how big that was in that moment, but I left and went home, and so much happened after that story. But I went to Hobby Lobby a week or so later, to buy flowers for Ryan's grave, which I hate doing, which is an awful thing, but I went because I had to do it. And there was a starfish paperweight. Mm. This is the end of February, early March. Like, it's not summertime. The beach stuff shouldn't be out yet. I mean, Christmas should be, you know, coming, but not yet. So I see the starfish and I pick it up and I was like, ah, you made a difference to that one. And I bought it. And it sits over there on my writing desk as a reminder every day. So when I sit there and write, I made a difference to that one. And so a couple weeks after that, I got on Amazon and ordered 100 starfish charms. I had no idea what I was going to do with them, but I'm like, I got to have these starfish. And so I, my husband thought I was crazy, and I said, I have a diagnosis. I really am. And I got these charms, and I didn't know what I was going to do with them. And then all of a sudden, one person after another would need something, and I would share the story of the first life I saved and the story of the starfish. And I would hand them this starfish, and I'm like, you need to be reminded of the difference you made. Like, they were either struggling in their job, or it was another student that came forward that was struggling that needed to say, I need help. I have plans to hurt myself. And so I started giving these starfish away to different people for different reasons and sharing the story over and over and over. And that now I'm, I don't know, 60 or 70 starfish down the road. I only gave out one during quarantine because I was in quarantine. And it was just a couple weeks ago, and it was like magical to share again and to say, this is what I'm supposed to do. I'm supposed to share, you know, I'm supposed to share part of my story. And it always comes out different the way I share it. The parts that get told and the parts that don't get told to different people. But it's just part of my story that I share now because it's where I am. It's not a story I want to share ever. It's always a nauseating feeling before when I hear somebody struggling, and I don't want to do it. I don't want to go talk to them. I don't want to ask them the questions. But every time I do, either a life is saved or something has changed. Good always comes from it. So it's just a reminder of that little starfish to share.
And you've been sharing, you know, you've gone around to other schools, right? Or what? Or groups? What have you been doing?
So right before quarantine, a middle school 2 hours away was a high school friend of mine. She's a counselor up there. And she had been following my Facebook story. And then I started kind of writing a blog here and there. And she used my blog post to teach suicide awareness at her school for a week. And so they read some of my blog posts. And I went and I shared different stories of the lives that I've helped save and different stories of kids that have come forward and just things that have happened. And just by going to that experience, I had to tell the story 6 times in one day, and I learned how big this really was. And I talked a lot about mental health and the tools I used, not necessarily just the suicide stories, just about tools that I used, and kids could see how, just like right now I just sound great. My voice is great. It's not cracking at all. I wish it could sound like this all the time. But there was a moment where I had 50 kids in there, and I could tell they weren't really listening to me very much, and I knew that I was disconnected. And I don't ever want to sound like this is my thing. I want it to never be normal. I don't want it to be okay. And so the counselor was across the room, and I walked over to her, and I'm like, I just don't feel her. I need something cold. And her arms were freezing. And I touched her arms, and the temperature was enough for me to like kind of ground myself that you are right here, right now. And I just started to cry, and the whole room, you know, got quiet. And I said, this is my real voice. You know, I'm not supposed to sound like an expert speaker because I'm not. That's not my gift. And so then I just started talking about more and more stories. And I did tell the starfish story in a couple different groups of the kids. And at the end of the day, I was in the last group. And that group of kids was so loud, they were just ready to leave. And I was telling the starfish story, and it got really quiet. And the door opened on the other side of the classroom, and a coach walked in and said, "I just need to tell you that the art teacher just came by, and there was a student in there last hour that said they learned that it's okay to not be okay, and that you really made a difference to them, and they drew this for you." And they held up the picture, and it was a starfish. And the whole room, you know, was like, "Oh my gosh." So it was little things like that that always happened. But even after the very first hour of talking, a student went forward, was admitted to the mental health facilities there, and was in the hospital for a week. So she came forward by hearing the story of the first life I saved, and that I will never be okay, that you should say the truth. When you ask people, "How are you?" don't ask them that if you don't really want to know the answer. And working in the middle school where I am now, I don't like kids to just say, "I'm okay." You know, I've taught them it's okay that you're having a bad day. Don't say you're okay when you're not, because words matter. What you say needs to be true. So it's okay to say, "I'm having a bad day," you know, but don't say, "I'm okay," when you're not okay.
Mm-hmm.
And so talking about that kind of stuff with middle school students, a life was saved just after the first hour. And then who knows the ripple effect of that, and what they go home and learn. And it encouraged, there were always two or three classes in there at a time. And so their teachers or coaches were in there listening. And one of the coaches shared at the end of the class, like, "You may not think this has anything to do with you right now, but I've been a teacher or coach for, I don't know how many years, 12 years. And he had lost several students to suicide. And he's like, "What she's saying is so important. Like, listen to your words." And it was neat that the chance I was given to speak then allowed somebody that they have in their own school to share his own story. Mm-hmm. And so it was really neat to watch it happen right before my eyes, to be present enough to see, "Oh, you got to be part of that." That's really...
It's not every day that you find a product that you truly love and want to shout about from the rooftops. Well, friends, I have found something that I am genuinely excited to share with you today, and that is Born Shoes. Born Shoes are made with the best top quality leather with functional stitching and flexibility. They are lightweight, but they're also supportive. They are great for all casual occasions, extremely comfortable, and especially good for travel. The brand recently gifted me a pair of the Ithaca style sandals. Of course, they are beautiful. The footbed has extra foam for added comfort and with a slight heel for lift. I am positive that I could walk all over London in this pair of shoes, just like I did in my Born sandals last summer. Born Shoes offers sandals, flats, boots, and heels in several styles and color choices. Take comfort in Born Shoes. Every season, they make high-quality shoes that feel as good as they look. With artistic touches, unparalleled craftsmanship, and exquisite materials, Born designs shoes to satisfy the demands of every lifestyle. Go to bornshoes.com for a 15% discount plus free ground shipping on all full-price shoes when you use my promo code TELL. That's Born, B-O-R-N, shoes, shoes.com, and use promo code TELL, T-E-L-L, for 15% off and free shipping. Available exclusively to our listeners for a limited time.
Amazing.
That is amazing. Do you feel like you're sharing in this community, or sharing on Facebook where this community sees it? Have you heard from other grieving parents, or there doesn't have to be parents, but just grieving in general, because they're like, in my mind, if I went through something, and it doesn't have to be your same story, but I just know from following you that you know what grief is. Like, I feel like I could come and be safe with my grief with you.
So that's big. Okay. So a lot of people wanted to share their trauma and wanted to share their grief. And I was not in a place to listen. I just couldn't do it. And one of the things I learned and that I try to teach people is that grief is different than trauma. And so for my situation, I felt like I had these two balls in the air, and one was grief and one was trauma. And I wasn't really grieving. I mean, definitely I was grieving, but I had so much trauma from the PTSD that I just felt like I was being jabbed and stabbed and physically in pain every day that I really feel like I didn't start grieving until the second year. It was a different kind of process that I had to go through. And
wait, let me ask this. Let me just clarify. The trauma was from the night he died.
Right, from finding him. I was the one that found him. And that trauma is what caused my PTSD. And
so you had to get through that before you were able to grieve the loss of a child, like that, you know, just the loss part.
Mm-hmm. Because I couldn't even, wow, there's just so much there. I've come so far. Like, that, it is amazing to think how far I've come, because I couldn't touch the carpet for a year. Mm-hmm. Because he was on the carpet. And so to have to learn how to touch carpet, to have to learn how to sit on carpet, like, people don't realize that they saw me as a grieving mother, but I was learning how to truly live, to fight a demon in my head all day long. Mm-hmm. Like, the triggers and the flashbacks were constant. I barely got a break in the beginning, and learning all that, you know, going through so much cognitive therapy and all different things that I had to do is why I'm here where I am today. So people want, they gravitated mm-hmm. towards me because they wanted to share their stories. All of a sudden I had different people that were affected by suicide sharing their story, different people that had lost siblings or anybody that wanted to share their story. That was really hard for me to hear. So I kind of distanced myself. Lots of grieving, or lots of parents that were not even in our town, but maybe somebody knew them. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. They were saying, "Oh, go read Amy's Facebook. You can learn from her." And so, lots of people that I didn't even know, complete strangers that had lost children years before, all of a sudden wanted to follow me. It was a huge kind of gift.
Oh, I was going to ask, was that a burden or a gift?
It was both. It felt very much in therapy, I would say. I just feel like I need to write because they need to hear, they need to see me heal. And over, my therapist and doctor were like, "You owe them nothing. Like, this is not your job to heal the world." You know, but at the same time, I'm like, I want to change the world. Like, yeah, mm-hmm. I wanted it to be real. And I loved that I was helping people. I mean, it gave me a purpose. Mm-hmm. I love that I was authentic, but also I can't control who reads my stuff on Facebook now. You know, there are settings now where I can block a few when I put a post out. But for the most part, I didn't know when I would write something, I don't know how you're going to respond. Your own life is going to affect your perception of what I'm writing. Your own, where if you're in a bad mood that day, you may think, "Oh, she just wants attention." I guarantee that any grieving parent is not looking for attention. They just don't want their child to be forgotten.
Mm-hmm. Is that why you stayed living in the house and in the town even?
That was one of the questions. Most people did not think we would continue to live here. A lot of times when children die from suicide, the family does move. Or when a child dies at all, a lot of times people will move. We were warned very early on about our marriage and our friendships. I can still picture myself sitting outside with our best friends one night and telling them that and saying, "We're probably not going to be friends. How are we going to get through this?" And hearing them say, "We can do this. We're going to do this together." And it is because of our best friends that showed up every day, that just continued to listen to us over and over, that we grew closer. You know, it definitely was, I don't want to say it was a choice, but we were making a choice every day to do the hard stuff, because mm-hmm. it would be so much easier to not say your feelings every day.
Mm-hmm.
It is really hard to say, "I am having a hard time." And so in the beginning, my husband was getting messages from the doctor and the therapist on, "You need to be looking for this, be watching her." he always said it was like having a baby deer in his lap. He never knew which way I would jump and how I would react to things. But now, you know, 3.5 years later, I now have to tell my family, I'm really good at sitting here, but I'm struggling. Like, it's actually harder now to tell somebody, I'm having a hard day, I'm struggling today.
Because of the time?
Because the timing, I think it was so expected that I would be grieving and having a hard time back then that it was constant. It was just like all the time. And now it's not as often, or I can deal with it with different tools or go outside and get some sunshine or have a walk or whatever. And if I don't do that and I let it build, you know, it's just so easy to push something away or scroll or go have a glass of wine or eat a bunch of chocolate. That's way easier. I mean, I'll do it every day over and over, but I won't be healthy. I won't be happy. And so eventually I have to get to that. I have to be able to say, I'm struggling and I'm having a hard time. And see, it makes me, every time to say you're struggling is just hard. Mm-hmm. But I struggle every day.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I'm just now kind of more at the point where I can hear other people's stories and kind of hold it. You know, be in the same space with them and be like, gosh, that's hard. But for the most part, you know, the first year or two, I just couldn't even, it was too much.
Of course, yeah.
We couldn't watch TV shows for months. We watched comedy, like comedians instead on Netflix. It was about the only show we could watch. And then we would pause it because we were laughing. It was like we felt guilty for laughing. But there were just too many triggers everywhere. And then all of a sudden, you know, like when you get pregnant, all of a sudden you notice every pregnant woman around, that kind of thing. So the word suicide just tended to stick out everywhere all of a sudden. And I went to the high school one day and I said to Ryan's group of friends, I said, I can just now kind of say the word suicide. Is anyone else having trouble saying that word? And you know, they were just so quiet. And one of the boys said, I can't say it. And another kid said, I can't say that he died. And he just started to cry. I mean, it was just little moments like that of just listening to my intuition, I guess, on just go to the high school and just start talking to these kids. They're amazing. Kids are amazing. We don't give them enough credit. Like, they want to talk about this stuff, and we are not letting them talk enough about it.
That's right.
I learned so much from them that year. It was amazing. Another student died from suicide. He was friends with Ryan. He had already graduated the year or two before, and he died about 9 months after Ryan. And I got so angry. I was like, we are not doing enough. What can we do? And I came up with this crazy idea with some of Ryan's friends. Like, we need to, every Monday in the lunchroom, we need to put our phones down and talk to each other. Like, let's build connections and no more social media. Like, let's get rid of the phones. And every Monday, we're just not going to have the phones. And so I started going after spring break every Monday to the lunchroom. And, you know, we made little signs for the table that said, no phone Monday or whatever. And the kids did it. And it's just so amazing to think that 400 kids in a lunchroom were doing what I asked them to do. One, like, I don't even know you guys, but this is great. And on week two, or maybe it was week three, I walked in, and at the end of the tables, they had made their cell phones into like phone pyramids. Like, they wanted to do this. Mm-hmm. This was not, of course, there'd be one or two kids on their phone. That was fine. But the fact that they wanted it, like, and so I just gradually started talking to every kid. I would go up and down the tables of all the kids and just like, hi, how's it going today? It's good to see you. And I would touch almost every kid. I immediately picked up on the kids who did not want to be touched. I'd never noticed that before until I got PTSD. But if any kid would kind of make a movement like they didn't want to be touched, I never touched them again. I learned who they were, and I would make eye contact and say, you know, it was good to see you. But for the next few weeks, I would go every Monday was my day, and I just started passing out fruit snacks. That was just magical, and they loved it. And one by one, I started hearing that kids were looking for me because I would show up every Monday. I never missed a Monday till the end of the school. And then it was just one kid after another started coming forward. Like, I look for you in the lunchroom. You're the only person that talks to me. I feel like you're the only person that cares. And they just started opening up and sharing. And then it was like, do you have plans to hurt yourself? And they would say, yeah. I mean, the things that they told me, I was just like, you guys are amazing. You're so much braver than I was at that age. And they had so much pain. And so I just got to be present in their life. And so the next school year, I just, every Monday was my snack day. And more kids, I mean, it's been over 30 kids now that have been saved through this little snack that I pass out. And they would come looking for me. And
saved meaning they would come tell you when they were having
they would find a way. They would either text me or they would Facebook me. They would send me an email through the school email. They would just show up at my office, because then at that time I was at the elementary, and now I've got moved to the middle school, so I'm closer to the high school. I can be on their campus just a few feet away. They would just start sending me messages like, hey, Miss Amy, how are you doing? You know, just random stuff. And like, is something going on? Like, I got to the point. I didn't have time to chit-chat with a 17-year-old. And so I'd say, is something going on? Yes, I'm having a hard time. What's, you know? And I learned with my therapist and the doctor direct questions to ask them to get them to the point, not to be drug out and stuff. And so a lot of them would say it. I would be on the other phone and I would be calling. This is a small town, so, you know, the chief police is our best friend. I could call an officer and they would go to the student's house. I'm like, this student is at risk. We need somebody there. You know, they would show up. So there is a benefit to the small town there.
But you know what that's teaching the whole student body, not just for those that are in pain, which obviously is a significant number, but even the kids who are just being mindful about putting their phones down on Monday. What they're learning as they go through their life is like, you know what, it felt good to not have my phone for an hour or whatever. And those kind of ripple effects, it's not always just about acute grief, which is clearly a huge part of your story, but just what you're teaching them in general, you
it
know, to
big.
Just think about your emotions, put your phone down, don't hold stuff in, like all the things that you're saying. It doesn't have to walk all the way down the road to death. You're starting this like way back here.
And they're just little tiny things that really are so big. It's such a little thing. I had a kid just a couple weeks ago. I was sharing the story about how the snack program started with the student that died, and why I started the SNAP program. And a couple days later, a student came to me and said, last fall, you gave me a piece of candy. You were the only person that talked to me that day, and I was suicidal at that time. It was a piece of candy. Like, it's that little. It's that little of just saying hi, making a difference. And I had forgotten the moment, but I remember him walking down the hall. And it's very natural. You know, teachers want to say, hey, smile, be happy, it's a great day, be positive, that kind of stuff. And I'm the opposite. I'm like, it's okay if you're having a bad day. You don't have to smile, but don't be mean to people. You know, like, you can have a bad day. And I remember seeing that happen. And as he got closer, I said, are you having a hard day? And he said, yeah. And so I followed him to his class. And as he sat down, I handed him a piece of candy and said, well, I hope this sweetens your day a little bit. You know, it was that little tiny bit of kindness that over and over in the school makes a difference. They just see that little act is so big. It does not have to be a grand gesture.
So you don't share daily on Facebook in the way that you did that first year or 18 months. How is your relationship to that now with social media and being almost 4 years past that day? You know, kind of where are you now? You're obviously sharing publicly, you're sharing in your real life. What is that relationship to social media or to being so public, I guess is what I'm saying.
About 3 months in, I wrote a public post that said, my therapist said that you have to stop sending so many words back to me.
Oh, I remember that.
But you had to have been following me at that time to know that. And so I wrote that you would instead like send me a heart emoji or something instead of putting words, because there were too many words coming at me.
Meaning the comments on your posts?
And so a lot of the comments were triggering me. And a lot of people didn't know that at the time that I had been diagnosed with PTSD. And so they didn't realize that they would maybe use the word suicide about somebody they had lost. They would comment in a way that would trigger me. And so I publicly put out there, I need you to limit your words back at me because I'm trying to heal. And so I got less and less comments. Then, of course, that always backfires on you because then you get more friends that were not there at the time. They don't know that happened. And so then somebody would comment and she'd be like, "You're not supposed to comment on her post." I'm like, "Oh my gosh, social media. Wow." There were also people like family members that shouldn't have been reading everything that I wrote, honestly, because they were not getting treatment on their own on their side, or they were processing it different, because you're only reading like a paragraph of my day and then they're processing it the way they see it in their own life, rather than if they were actually here in the house and had seen me that day. They were only getting a really tiny glimpse of it, and it became more and more, it just wasn't. I did lose friends. I do have family that I don't associate with as much because of his death. I mean, it just is what it is. It's awful, but I can't control how other people are going to react.
So they were judging you, or they were thinking that you weren't telling the whole truth because they were only seeing a small thing? Like, it was affecting your relationship offline, basically.
Yes, because they weren't here all day. They were taking that little bit and turning it into what they thought it was, rather than the truth of what it was. Nobody really knows the truth except for my husband. He was here every day. And then our best friends were here every day too, and they had to watch so much of the therapy that I went through. But I don't know. Mm-hmm. I mean,
but did that make you post less?
Yeah, it made me post less because I didn't like the reaction. The comments. I couldn't handle the comments. And so I started a blog because you wouldn't have to have the immediate feedback. You know, it was just like I put it out there. Well, then I was getting private messages and stuff, and they just were not appropriate. Like, I can't believe some of the things people say. And once again, I just had so much grace for people because they have good intentions. They do not live in my shoes and walk in my shoes every day. They didn't know that this morning when I woke up, the first image was not a good one, and I fought all day to breathe. You know, they don't see that part of it. So social media in the beginning was very healing and helped so many other people heal. And that way when I went out in public, maybe they wouldn't say. They did learn how to grieve a little bit differently, I hope. And to respond to me and talk to me. But as time went on, it just became harder for me to share publicly on Facebook a lot. Now, every once in a while, I will go crazy to sit down and write and to post it. Every single one of my posts, I always think is terrible.
What?
My husband has never, he's only read two or three. And that was within like last year when I would say, read this before I post it. I always thought they were like, this isn't any good. And I'd put it on there. And yeah, I always doubt myself. I always wonder if this is even helpful, or it's weird what your mind can do to you. And that's part of my morning routine. Every morning, you know, I have to write affirmations about myself and tell me I was very nervous about doing this. But at the same time, I'm like, all I'm doing is sharing this. The truth of my story. There's no.
Were you nervous about doing this because it was public? Because just talking about it, it'll take you a few days to recover from this. Like, what?
Definitely, I have therapy booked for tomorrow. I'm so glad it's sunny today. I'll go outside and sit in my swing again. I have learned that after I share, I do have to have a downtime. I have to debrief, basically. I was nervous because no one wants to talk about suicide. It's an awful subject. No one wants to talk about grief, but boy, we need to talk about grief more and how to help people grieve. Quarantine was great. I listened to so many more podcasts on grieving and on different parts of it and why people do things. And that was a nice downtime for me on learning so much about why I do what I do. And because grief is not what I thought it was. It's just a whole lot messier, and it will pop up when you least expect it in ways that you don't know. And if I haven't done my work for just grieving or for my PTSD, it will come out a different way, in an inappropriate way. There is truth to that. So if I don't do my morning routine, I might be able to skip a day or two, especially on vacation. But I'm just now to the point where I talk to my husband in the morning. Like, that's how much work this is. It's, mm-hmm. It is a daily process of reminding myself who I am. And at one point I was writing that I was loved every day. Now I don't have to do that. I know that I'm loved. I'm just so thankful that I am loved and that I don't have to write that every day. But I do have to write that I'm qualified to speak of this. Like, mm-hmm. You don't get a degree. This is a life experience. And it really is just the little tiny things that I'm doing every day of being authentic in real life that are so much bigger than anything I've shared on Facebook. Mm-hmm. I mean, the one-on-one people conversations is life-changing, really life-saving in so many circumstances. So
it is, and I'm just so honored that you would trust me to have this conversation publicly, and I hope that your sharing, which I've observed now for years and years, and now other people can get a glimpse into it, that it will help someone that listens to this. I have absolutely no doubt that it will. I know that it will.
Right. I can't wait to see really what comes from it. I know good will come. And so I have something for you.
Oh.
Because you've made such a difference in so many lives with your new book.
And it's a starfish, everyone.
It's a starfish. And so this is yours.
Oh, and that's so beautiful.
I just really wanted you to know that you've made a difference just in this last year with the book club, because that helped me to start sharing online again, just in that group. And so I was like, oh, I'm giving her a starfish.
Oh, so you are so
I don't know
kind.
What number you are, but that's yours.
I will cherish this.
So when you doubt or forget the difference that you make, I hope you pull that out and go, I did make a difference.
I did. I'm going to keep this where I can always keep it. It will remind me of you and sharing and Ryan and your family and the importance of all of this. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
I'm Laura Tremaine, and you've just listened to the 10 Things to Tell You podcast. You can find the show notes and subscribe to episode emails at 10thingstotellyou.com/podcast. And you can follow us on Facebook and Instagram at 10 Things to Tell You. Remember, this is an interactive podcast. I have 10 things to tell you, and you have 10 things to tell. So take this topic to your journal or a friend, or post on social media using the hashtag 10 Things to Tell You. These episodes are meant to bring connection with others and ourselves and spark better conversations. Thanks for listening. Now go share something.